shooting out sparks over 38 states, the Canadian plains, and the tequila fields of Mexico.
A program most deserving of a grand introduction.
The Nocturnal Journal.
The talk of the town. WGN Radio 720.
With your guide, Dave Hoekstra. Daytime turns me off and I don't mean maybe.
9 to 5 ain't taking me. Thank you, Dan Long, for that introduction. Dan, this is our third annual baseball special, preseason special tonight, and we're going to have Mike Vec on in a little bit in the next half hour. We're beginning with noted Chicago author and big baseball fan, Robert Kersen. Thank you so much for coming in, Robert.
Dave, you're one of my favorite people in the world, so I'm honored and privileged to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming in, and thanks for saying that. You've got a new book out, Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. Fascinating book.
Thank you. Apollo 8 is one of the great undertold stories in our country's history. It was the first time mankind ever left Earth and the first time mankind ever arrived at the moon. And it happened at Christmas 50 years ago, 1968, at the very, very end of one of the most terrible years in our country's history.
Yeah.
And it was a uniting event that brought the entire country together.
How'd you get the idea for this? And we tell listeners, I mean, you did Shadow Divers, you do these crashing through pirate history, right. These kind of, I don't know if I call them adventure, but exploration books.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely exploration, true adventure. The way I got this one actually went back to Shadow Divers. I was at the Museum of Science and Industry showing some friends the U-505, which is a perfect match for the rare Type 9C-40 U-boat I write about these guys discovering off of the coast of New Jersey in 1991. That was the subject of the book Shadow Divers I wrote, my first book. So showing them around and showing them this spectacular exhibit they have at the museum. And on the way out, I went past a space capsule, and it said Apollo 8. And it seemed strange to me because I knew a lot about Apollo 11, which is, of course, the first moon landing, and about Apollo 13, where there was an explosion near the moon, and the crew led by Jim Lovell almost didn't make it back. But I knew very little about Apollo 8. So when I got home, I started to research it, and it seemed to me, the more I read, the more spectacular it seemed, until I was convinced that Apollo 8 was the single most daring, risky, and maybe important space mission NASA ever ran. And when you heard other astronauts talk about it, including Neil Armstrong, they were speaking in reverential terms about Apollo 8, that nobody knew you could go to the moon until Apollo 8 proved it. They were the first, and it was spectacularly dangerous and risky and incredibly beautiful. They accomplished amazing things on the journey.
How important was it that 1960 had the backdrop of 1968? I mean, 1958, 1978, but 1968, how important was that to what happened?
It was everything. I mean, we have the two assassinations, Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy. We have violence in the streets, not a mile from here, at the Democratic National Convention. The Tet Offensive is going on in Vietnam. There are terrible images coming out of that year, including that execution in Vietnam where the guy shoots another guy in the head who's handcuffed. But here, there's all kinds of terrible things happening. There's terrible race problems. The country is divided against itself. And you have the sprinters in Mexico City holding up one black glove fist to protest racism that they saw at home. It seemed every week brought worse and worse news. And more than that, nobody seemed to trust each other. It was every group against every other group. And here at the very, very end, in the last week of 1968, man is going to attempt to go to the moon, of all things. Part of it's done to keep the Apollo program moving because it had stalled for various reasons relating to the lunar lander, which wasn't ready to go yet. But there was a lot of the motivation to rush this thing to the moon, and it was rushed, Dave. It was done. This whole plan was put together in 4 months, not the usual 12 to 18. They were really hurrying to go. A big part of it was to beat the Soviets to the moon because it looked like the Soviets were going to get the first men around the moon. And so here comes this thing at the end of the very tail end of the very worst year. And they're going for something that's virtually impossible. And here they're going to try to pull it off. So everybody was paying attention. And in fact, on Christmas Eve, nearly a third of the world's population would tune in to hear the broadcast from around the moon.
Now, you have an event. It's sold out April 5th at the Museum of Science and Industry with
the crew of Apollo 8.
Yeah,
they'll all be here. Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders are all coming in for the event. They are the first three human beings ever to leave Earth and ever to arrive at the moon. So it's a very special kind of thing. Jim Lovell turns 90 tomorrow.
Isn't that something?
It's amazing. Frank Borman is 90 and Bill Anders is 85. And just as sharp as ever, three of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. But very special to have them all together to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8.
And as a writer to a writer, how'd you track them down? How'd you gain their trust? Were there other reference points? Did they know your other work? Did they talk about the right stuff? I mean, what was there, you know?
I was lucky. I was a friend of mine passed along a contact information for Jim Lovell. And it was lucky he recognized me. He actually had read Shadow Divers.
Oh, yeah.
Had been a fan of it. So I think he appreciated my work. And it helped that I only lived about 15, 20 minutes from him. So it was easy enough to go see him and to meet him.
And so I didn't know that. He's a Chicago area guy?
He's local. And it was he's just one of the nicest, warmest individuals you'll ever meet in your life. And I had a very nice connection with him, and it went from there. He introduced me to the other two astronauts, and we were off to the races.
You mentioned your other books. I mean, we've been talking about that. What did you learn from those other books that you brought into this book? What kind of process is that? I mean, I'm sure every book brings a new discovery for you as a writer.
Yeah, by this time I expected that the research for the book would take about two-thirds of the total time. The writing comes relatively easy to me once I've accomplished all the research and structured the book in my mind. But what I love to do is learn the story firsthand from the people. So I try not to learn too much before I go in. I don't want to be an absolute master of the story before I talk to the principals themselves, because often that'll stop me from asking questions that might produce really fruitful answers.
That's interesting.
So I like to go in knowing enough where I can speak intelligently, but not too much. And that's what I tried to do with them, and it worked out beautifully.
You went to law school. I don't know. You've been on the show before, but I don't know if I asked you this. How does that play into your ability to ask questions and your mind to get facts?
I think it really does. One of the, I did not like my law school experience, and I certainly did not like being a lawyer. But the one thing law school really did for me was teach me to think clearly. You know, legal writing is really the process of making an argument, a logical argument. And I think good, clear writing is much the same, where you're laying out an argument, you're trying to establish what happened and how one thing leads to another. So in that sense, it really did help.
There's a character you talk about in your credits here, Dave Shapson at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes,
you would go to the open pantry. Was it 7-Eleven or open pantry?
Yeah, open pantry.
And back then, you were interested in this type of stuff even back then. Right?
Yeah, I got dumped by a girlfriend very early in my freshman year. Unfortunately, it's a scenario that would play out often for me over the years. But this was a first. And, losing a first love is one of the most painful things. You think you'll never recover. You're 18 years old. So I was wandering the streets of Madison.
I still do that, Bob.
It's one of the best places to wander.
Yeah, right.
So, it was probably 3 a.m. or something like that. And I thought there was, I didn't know if night would ever turn into day again. And I wandered into the one place that was still lit, and that was this open pantry. And I saw this guy thumbing through space and astronomy magazines and struck up a conversation with him. And he just was one of the most interesting and kind and curious people I'd ever met. And he became one of my closest friends and is to this day, and helped me immensely on this book. This is a book that, had we known all those years ago, 30 plus years ago, that one of us would write someday, we would have been beside ourselves with joy. But nobody knew it at the time. But here it is all these years later, and we kind of teamed together, and he became my primary researcher on this.
I'm a little older than you, probably, right? A little bit.
Well, I'm 54.
Okay. Well, I'm 8 years older. So, but I remember being a kid and the John Glenn stuff and being in school and stopping school to watch the, it was just such a sense of wonder and the dreams. And it was just such a fascinating, it was a big, big deal. Did these guys in 68, was that still going on, or what happened to that?
Yeah. Well, in 68, I remember every launch that was during school hours, they would stop. And we had these little black and white TVs bolted onto the wall. They were probably all of, 13-inch TVs or something like that. But people, even in kindergarten, were absolutely dead silent. You knew something unbelievable was happening. It was really like out of the pages of science fiction that these guys were going to dare to sit on top of a rocket with the power of a small nuclear bomb, light it off, and try to aim for the moon and get there. It just seemed unbelievable. And the great thing about this story and stories of Apollo in general are that the wonder you had when you were 5 years old or 10 or 15 years old has stayed just as intense and bright as it was when you were a kid. And there's very few things you can say that about. You know, everything that we loved and that was larger than life back then when we were children, we've become accustomed to and a little bit numb to, but not this. This is as thrilling today, 50 years later, to think of guys leaving Earth and arriving at a new world as it was back then when we were little kids.
Excellent. We're going to take a break here. Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon by Robert Kurson. We'll be back. We'll talk more about the book, and we're going to talk a little baseball. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal. And I think it's going to be a long, long time. The touchdown brings me round and get too fine. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN in Chicago. In the studio, we have Robert Kurson, the author of Rocket Men. It's out now, right, Robert?
No, it comes out April 3rd.
April 3rd, and your thing is April 5th.
And the event is at the museum is April 5th, yes.
Yeah, but it's sold out.
Sold out.
But what's the website? How can people find the book?
Just go to Robert Kurson, KURSON.com, and you could also pre-order it on Amazon now as well.
Okay, I got a couple questions for you, but I want to introduce our guest on the phone, Mike Vec. Mike, are you there?
Hello there, Dave Hoekstra.
How are you, Michael? How you doing?
I'm groovy. How you be?
Okay, this is our third year of this baseball special, so we're really excited that we've been doing this for 3 years. You know a few things about rockets and explosions and fireworks, don't you, Michael?
Well, I don't know. It's reported that I was there on July 12th, and you know you wouldn't know it from the White Sox, but every once in a while, I still admire things that blow up.
So, Bob, you have a story. You've had an encounter with Michael. So
I have a Mike Vec story.
This is Bob Kurson. Yeah.
Hi, Bob.
How are you, Mike?
I'm well, thank you.
If you'll indulge me, I want to tell my Mike Vec story because it's one of my favorite stories that I've experienced in my life. So I was a very unhappy, disgruntled lawyer one time long ago. And I knew I had to get out of the business. I was making a lot of money, but I was profoundly depressed. And I thought to myself, the only two things I really love in the world are writing and baseball. And I need to get out of this. And I didn't know how to get into writing, and I didn't know how to get into baseball at all. But I'd remembered my dad, who had been a vendor for the Cleveland Indians when he was a kid, telling me such nice stories about Bill Vec, including selling him 8 hot dogs and getting a $50 bill and not needing change back. And so I thought, I'm going to write a letter to Mike Vec and just tell him, I'm unhappy, I love baseball, what can I do? And I got a letter back from you, and it said, meet me at the winter meetings in Dallas, and I'll introduce you to people. And I couldn't believe the gesture of kindness, and I bought my airplane ticket, and I went out to Dallas, and you introduced me to people and even got me a job offer from the fledgling Lansing Lugnuts at the time. And it was one of the kindest gestures that someone ever did for me. I ended up not taking the job. I went instead to work for the Sun-Times Sports Department, which is where I first met Dave. and that worked out for me. But I never forgot the gesture of kindness, and I'm grateful to thank you for it today.
Well, that's very kind. I only have two things. My old man asked me to see if you had change for that 50.
Did you?
And the other thing was, I obviously saved you from a life of sin hanging around with some of those guys in baseball. So that's very.
Well, I'm grateful for it.
Mike, since we're talking about books, I mean, I talked to your dad. I met your dad late in life but we would talk when he was doing the show with Shulian on Channel 11 but everybody, a lot of people know about just the love of literature. What was it like growing up with all the books in the house and what an avid reader he was? And
one of the things that always intrigued me, was the dad would always say, you know, I don't really understand this rock and roll stuff, and I sure don't care for it very much. But I suppose it's akin to when we were growing up, referring to himself, he said we wanted to be the next great writer. And so unlike today where the media, you know, is looked at with a kind of a jaded at best and much worse, they were revered in our house because they were wordsmiths. Anyone who wrote for a living or even, you know, electronically worked on the radio were storytellers, as people are prone to say today. They were revered. And so the house was piled high. And it didn't matter what kind of literature. There was great respect. There would be a Norman Mailer resting on top. Of what we commonly call great literature, Umu and T.P. and Moby Dick. So it was a widespread interest, and he was mostly self-taught. And so we had the utmost respect for the written word, and it was really probably one of his most striking features. Was it made him a great contrarian, it made him a great conversationalist. You know, he would like to look off into the distance and wax eloquently, and it all came from the printed word.
For both you guys, for Robert and Mike, were there baseball books you liked growing up, or was that part of your thing?
Oh, yeah. If you hadn't read Win Hadley, I don't know about you, Robert, but if you hadn't read Win Hadley, and of course, there were certain people who could, you know, who could do no wrong. Charles T. Farrell wrote a great series of books. And then writers, of course, everybody from Gordon Cobledick, from our respective youths, for The Plain Dealer. Baseball columnists more, and collections, of course, Red Smith, rather than any kind of novel or the like. At least that was my. James T. Farrell was a great favorite in our house.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites.
Charles Van Loan. There's a name for your listeners to look up and make themselves crazy, but at the turn of the century did some great writing on horse racing and baseball.
So we got a minute before the break, but Robert, do you want to say?
Well, only one of my favorite books growing up was by writer named Lawrence Ritter, and now I can't remember the name of the book.
That's something of our time.
The glory of their time. Yeah, and it remains one of the greatest books, not just baseball books or sports books, but any kind of book. The way he captured the voices and the rhythms of old time baseball players, I could read it over and over, and I always felt like that made me a better writer to listen to the voices of people in addition to just telling the story itself.
We got to take a break for David Jennings in the news. We're going to come back. We're going to talk more baseball. We're going to bring on Soup Grande from the Ozark Mountain Daredevils, who wrote a song called I Married a Cubs Fan, I believe. Don't go away on Nocturnal Journal on WGN.
She said, would you like to join us? Here, let me move my cap. She picked it up from my chair and she put it in her lap. When we all stood up to leave, all that I could see was two big blue eyes underneath the big red sea. I married a Cubs fan.
What?
I married a Cubs fan.
What?
I married a Cubs
fan. Yes, sirree. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. That's Michael Soup Grande. I married a Cubs fan. He's going to join our little panel in the studio. We have Robert Kirsten, author of Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8, and the astronauts who made man's first journey to the moon. And Robert, you're a Cubs fan. I know that.
Lifelong.
And on the phone, I don't know where you are, Michael, but you know, you write this book. I was telling Robert during the break, you don't promote your books, but I picked this up in St. Paul last year. Another boring, derivative piece of crap business book. You co-wrote that. It's a fantastic book. I keep it by my desk.
I appreciate that, but you know, after writing Fun is Good, people just pigeonholed it as a baseball book, and you know, it's applicable to business, which I never thought would come out, but suddenly team building and having fun and innovation are key words, and so you find yourself rebirthed, if you will.
Yeah, and once we start with Michael, I want to go back into the book, like with chat with little essays like "Everyone Hates a Mime Except Me." So we'll talk about that. But Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, my friend, and I'm sitting here at home in Nashville, Tennessee.
So, you know, I know you through music and some of the projects we've worked on, but then we start talking about baseball. You're really, really hardcore. Somewhere I just saw a post or something. I mean, you really were tight with the 81, 82 Cardinals. You were hanging around in the clubhouse.
Well, I was born and raised in St. Louis, so I was a diehard, and still am a diehard Cardinal fan. I started the Daredevils in the 70s. In the 80s, I befriended some of the players. Danny Cox, Keith Hernandez, Bruce Sutter, Jeff Lottie. They invited me into the clubhouse and the dugout, and I took them up on the offer, and I realized right off the bat that a baseball team is nothing but a rock and roll band with 25 guys in it.
Michael, I mean, we were talking. Can you respond to that? I mean, I know you have a love for music. You played in a rock and roll band, and you've done rock and roll promotions. Talk about the parallels.
Well, there's no question that there's a certain entertainment, certainly from the baseball aspect. And the most the problem I have, and this is for you, Michael, is we're immediately friends because the one thing that unites us is we both hate the Cubs with such
well, see,
intensity.
I don't hate the Cubs. I don't mind the Cubs.
You married a Cubs fan.
I enjoy the rivalry. And I really enjoy coming to Wrigley to watch the Cardinals play in Wrigley. And I really like it when the Cub fans come down to Busch because it's just one big giant party. You know, there's no ill feelings. It's just kind of a feel-good rivalry, and I enjoy that.
Matt, when was the last time?
What that's like.
Mike in Nashville, when was the last time you were up here for a ball game?
It was in the 80s.
You wouldn't believe it. I mean, I just drove by there the other day, and Robert might want to. Mike Vec, I don't know when the last time you were there, but it's looking like South Beach up there by Wrigley Field. It's crazy. I mean, that hotel, and it's really getting fancy.
Yeah. Well, I came up with the, like I said, with the 80s team. I started writing. I wrote a monthly essay, a column that got published in various publications up around the St. Louis area about the Cardinals. So I got invited to Wrigley with the team, two or three homestands up there, and I just had an absolute ball, man, absolute ball.
What was Whitey Herzog like? Was he okay with you hanging around the clubhouse and stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, God, yeah. And then who was even better than that was Tony.
Tony La Russa?
Yeah, La Russa. Yeah. he's just an old rock and roller.
Yeah,
he loves music.
Yeah.
He loves music, too.
Yes, he does.
He's in our Disco Demolition book, now that I think about it. I think he said he's real good friends with Dennis DeYoung.
Yeah.
We just got over Disco Demolition.
I love that Disco Demolition night. The whole scenario is fantastic.
So then talk about you marry the woman from Springfield, Illinois.
Yes. I was about in my mid-50s. I got another chance at romance, and it was really, I feel really fortunate for the opportunity. Fell head over heels for her. Baseball didn't come up until the third date. And by then, I was hooked. And then it was just kind of funny. But it's a situation that is in a lot of households in that corridor between St. Louis and Chicago.
Yeah.
So, and then I said, well, I'm just going to write a funny little song about the situation. Now, there's also, if your listeners go to YouTube, I made a video for that song, I Married a Cubs Fan, and you can see it, a funny little Benny Hill video on YouTube. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. We make the odd couple, but just our luck, we both like Harry Carey, and we both like Jack Buck. All you guys, Mike, we talk about this every year, but Mike Vec, about the status of the game. And I was going through some notes and some stuff your dad said about the pace of the game. He had ideas, limiting or eliminating the practice of throwing the ball around the infield after outs, limiting the number of warm-up pitches allowed at the start of the inning. Here's one that came true, making the intentional walk automatic rather than requiring four balls to be thrown, deadening the ball. All of you gentlemen, do you think the game is too slow?
I think it's a respite. I have to say, I think it's one of those things to be enjoyed, and I think that the pastoral setting and all lends itself to a subtle, you know, romance, a subtle nuance. But there's no question that, you know, you don't need music every time they get in the batter's box. The 20-second clock should be enforced. We tried in the American Association, which obviously our St. Paul Saints, for example, are a member of. We tried to enforce it. The problem with that is the umpires. But you can come in around 2:05, 2:10 if you really work at it in the length for a game and make it, I think, more enjoyable for the fans.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I'm not an old curmudgeon. Well, Babe Ruth didn't have a pitch clock. I'm not one of those guys. If a few amendments can enhance the game, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Robert?
Well, I think that the problem with the length of games isn't with the game itself, but I think when you have, let's say, a 7:05 start at Wrigley Field and you're looking at a three-hour-plus game, it's very hard to bring kids or a family on a weeknight and expect to go home after 10 o'clock and then wait for the L and everything. It becomes a past midnight affair, and I think that's part of the problem as well.
Yeah, that's true. I agree with you.
Yeah. I like earlier starts.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Michael, how are things going in all your teams? Are you still down in Bloomington Normal too?
Yes. Yeah, we've still got Bloomington Normal, and then closer to St. Louis, River City, and then of course my beloved St. Paul Saints, which we're starting year four in the new ballpark, which is we're going to honor the 40 years of Animal House. Now, that makes me feel old. And Mr. Rogers, that unsung hero of people our age, Mr. Rogers.
I love doing this every year. I love, last year we did this, and we talked about the Mary Tyler Moore night. I ended up driving up there and throwing my TAM in the air for Mary Tyler Moore night. But look at, okay, so June 13th, celebrating 50 years of Mr. Rogers. And Saints players will ride to the ballpark in a trolley, so you enjoy this afternoon matinee. It's great. It's just great stuff. What's the one you've got? Talk about the pigs up there. You're going to unveiling. This is on May 22nd. Unveiling of Monument Pork with triple ball pig bobble giveaway. So talk about your pig stick up there, Michael.
Well, it's like it's like Michael the second time around in I married a woman, Libby, who loves pigs, and of course St. Paul was an outpost originally on the Mississippi known as Pig's Eye Station, and so we've decided to have a live pig as our mascot, and every year the fans name them, and so we've been all over the place from Kevin Bacon, Piggy Smalls, the notorious P.I.G., and fans just have a really wonderful time coming up with it. So the pigs are actually better known than some of our players, so we've decided to enshrine them, ripping the Yankees off and installing Monument Pork, commemorating 25 years of some of the greatest pigs I have known.
And then one more, and this
I'm just saying.
I love it.
And one more, and then I got another question about independent ball. But August 29th, you want to mark this down, the world's largest sologamy ceremony?
If you can't love yourself, love the one you're with. And, that we come into the world with that person, so we're going to marry everybody who feels, that intensely about themselves. Let's face it, we got to take a shot at everybody.
Soup, I smell a road trip from Nashville up to St. Paul for that, Soup.
Oh, man, yeah. That sounds like a blast.
Okay, we got to take a break here for some spots, and we're going to be back and talk more baseball and books on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN. And we've got three authors, three baseball fans on the show. That was a little bit of You Want to Get to Heaven. And Michael, you wrote, or Mike Soup, you wrote a book, It Shine, the Saga of the Ozark Mountain Daredevils. How can people find that?
You can find it on my website, which is soupline.com. That's spelled SUPELINE. Or else you can go to the Daredevils website, OzarkDaredevils.com. And also, you know, like Amazon and that kind of thing. Yeah. So it's easily found. It's called It Shined, and it's been on 6 or 7 years now, yeah.
Okay. Robert, Rocketmen, one more time how people can find that.
Yeah, you could go to my website, Robert Kurson, KURSON.com, or find it on Amazon or any good bookstore.
And Mike Vack. Mike Vack, another boring derivative piece of crap business book. Where can people find that?
It's Amazon also, or the funisgoodteam.com, which is our website.
I mean, I can't encourage, you know, this is a great book. All these books are good. I mean, do you remember, I'm just going to throw this right at you, what I learned about starting today from Mr. Blue, the talking bird. And then you follow these promotions up with a business lesson. But remember, you talk about Mr. Bird.
Yeah, Michael would love this. I always wanted to have a bird named Blue call balls and strikes, put him in a cage and hang him out with the fans. I thought it would be great. So I called all the networks and told them after a month and a half that we'd trained a bird to call balls and strikes. We had 6,000 people in St. Paul. The bird's in a beautiful gilded cage in more ways than two. And the first pitch comes, and the bird is silent. And I look at the bird, and I look at the handler, and the handler goes, he's obviously got fright from the crowd. I said, what? Said, you didn't tell me there were going to be all these people here. He's got stage fright. I'm like, let me just understand. I paid $2,000 for a bird to get stage fright. So, you know, not every gag is going to work. And you better have those become the fodder for great stories and mediocre books.
Well, yeah. But the book is full of stories like that. Then you give advice. Give up doing this, thinking your safest ideas are actually your safest ideas. Usually they're the ones that blow up, not the crazy ones. Do this instead.
Yeah.
Ask what can go wrong at the very beginning, but don't let any of the naysayers kill the idea. That was my problem with the Sun-Times.
well, I do that when I'm writing songs.
Same thing with you, Soup? Really?
Yeah. Yes, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
Michael, did you ever think you'd live to see the day where WGN would be a flagship White Sox station? This is big news here in Chicago, Soup.
Oh, man.
Let me tell you something, and it's not because Soup's on, but it's like the Cardinals. Remember the first day they weren't on KMOX? The world just wasn't quite right.
That's exactly right. I remember that.
Great.
Yeah, was it a couple years?
Isn't that right? Yeah. People were just like, and that's how I feel. I think that, you know, I can almost hear a brick house in the background going, oh, it's the way it should be. You know, but this is a great thing for White Sox fans.
Well, the good thing for White Sox fans, it's going to have a stronger signal. I mean, it's going to have a regional signal.
It's going to have a signal.
Yeah.
Period.
I didn't bring it in, but there was that, I don't know if you saw, Robert, there was a Forbes, I think it was a thing this week, a couple of weeks ago, where they rated all the ballparks. Actually, Wrigley Field came in 10th, but whatever they call it now, I still call it the Cell or Comiskey. It was toward the bottom. Mike, what would you do to jazz up that ballpark?
I'd make sure that the first thing you did was that you catered entirely to the kids. I would design every gag so that it was kid friendly. So I'd have more and more people walking around. I think they've done a pretty good job to soften, you know, the last 20 rows because it was built very steep. It was right on the cusp. And so it's hard to turn that into the cell, into the friendly confines. And, of course, it's a terrible name. I'm a lifelong White Sox fan. But, you know, I don't think you can get all that out in one sentence. Guaranteed rate forever. We won't go to 18%. whatever the name of the ballpark is. But I would concentrate on nothing but kids. You know, if kids are in the wrong seat, I'd give them a medal. I'd have them crawl over fans in expensive seats. And I'd let them on the field. I'd make sure that before games and after games, players were accessible. People then think you have the greatest operation if their kids can get to their heroes.
And they should do that now with all these young players, because kind of, I mean, the fans are going to grow up with these young players. They'll be entrenched if they sign them to good contracts. You know, they'll be around for a while, you know, so it's something.
Yo, I know what my first giveaway would be. Yo-yos.
Yeah, for Moncada. Yeah, that's great. Mike Vec, you're sharp at this late hour.
He's on fire.
That's great. Yo-yos for Moncada. Write that down, Dan. We'll get a promotion. Maybe it'll give us another hour. So thank you. We're out of time. But thank you, guys. This was a lot of fun. Thanks, Robert Kirsten, for coming in and
thank you,
being
Dave.
My sidekick tonight.
I loved it.
Nice to see you, Amy. We'll talk about the vacation next time. I want to talk about your trip to Tokyo. Thanks, Soup. We're going to see you maybe in a couple months, right?
Yep. Yep,
in Nashville.
Down in Nashville.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us. And Mike Vec, I love you.
I love that town. Super, it was a real honor. I played a number of your tunes in a traveling rock and roll band poorly, but at least you know you live, baby.
Thank you, my friend. I look forward to sitting down for libations one evening.
Okay. All right, thanks, you guys. Thanks for listening. Thanks, Dan Long, and we'll talk to you next week.